This is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American. Today, I have with us as our guest, Aaron Baer, who wrote the book Exponential Theory. Now, Aaron does a great job about talking to businesses about what it is that they need to do to be able to build companies that can grow exponentially. But today, we're going to talk about this whole theory about exponential growth, why it's happening, what's changed in our economy that's making that take place, how is it that we take advantage of it, the effect that government can have on slowing that down or speeding that up, and why that ends up becoming important to us strategically. In addition to that, we're going to cover a lot about what you can do in your own business to help make your business grow faster. In any event, if you like what it is that we're doing, just go ahead and push that subscribe button, and let's go ahead and get started with Aaron Baer. Aaron, I'd like to welcome you to The Optimistic American.
Thank you, Paul.
All right, so we're going to talk about your book. We're going to talk about the book of Exponential Theory. But there's so much more to you. I mean, you have political involvement. You've been, you used to be a high-up figure inside the Republican Party, and yet you became part of the No Labels group. You've also effectively been involved with helping out lots of corporations grow. You're in the middle of writing a new book. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to maybe kind of back up for just a moment. And if you can, when you were writing Exponential Organization, and both of us, I think, know that there really was a lot of infrastructure that's been laid on this topic. In fact, one of the arguments that's been made was that the United Nations back in the 1990s set out this challenge to try and have us cut poverty in half within a five-year period of time. And we far exceeded that. And all these books started coming out of it. Yeah. Rational Optimists, Ray Kurzweil started writing books. Peter Diamentes wrote some. And they were, it was interesting because they were all talking about how we're growing, the things that are taking place, the changes that are happening. I like Peter, who wrote The Singularity is Near, when he, first book I think I read of his was actually called The Age of the Spiritual Machine, written back when I was mayor. And he made all these projections, which I didn't think would come true. I went back and looked at the book, and it's like, okay, you hit a lot of—
I think it was like 46 of 50.
Yeah, exactly.
Some amazing number, yeah.
So let's start there. Let's start by talking about why is it different today? Why are businesses able to grow at an exponential rate? Why is it that we have these unicorns that are taking place?
Well, it goes to mindset. And I think that, you know, what I started to learn when I wrote Exponential Theory was I started studying these great thinkers that just thought differently. And so I'll kind of share how I stumbled into this. For about 15 years, and I'd say my career as a profession has been a facilitator on the board and senior leadership team level. So I would go into boardrooms and, you know, you'd have a lot of egos and a lot of experience around the table that often was not exponential because it was caught up in what they knew. And there comes a certain point that if you don't have that inner child or that childlike behavior to look at the world in a curious way, you stop thinking bigger. You start thinking like what's possible. And it's kind of like the ability to change becomes harder because you really kind of start building these stone walls about what you believe, and your beliefs come so rigid. And I think that's affected our political system. It's affected, you know, our social connections and environment. Social media has a big impact on that because it's polarized people. But when it comes to really people in society, you know, kind of moving towards being exponential, and I'll kind of use Ray Kurzweil and Peter Diamentes because I was actually entrepreneur in residence at Singularity University where they found. And so I was surrounded by entrepreneurs and people that thought big. And in fact, Larry Page would come in, who was the founder of Google, and he would say, I'm not interested in talking to anybody that doesn't have an idea that impacts a billion people. Well, now all of a sudden, all your small ideas fall away and you start thinking bigger. So I kind of fell in love with thinking bigger. One, it literally released all this stress, worries, and anxieties about all these small things. And then I was in these really big conversations. So as a facilitator, I started bringing that into the boardroom to say, how do I help people think longer term and how to help them think bigger? Because everyone's caught in this vicious cycle, politicians, but also companies. They got to get next quarter's earnings. You know, and Amazon and Jeff Bezos had a very long-term vision for where Amazon was going to be and had the vision of where it's at. maybe not where it's at now. It's probably exceeded some of his expectations. But the fact is for 19 years, he trained analysts to rethink what profit meant to a company. And I think a lot of these exponential companies now that are extremely in control of their future with revenues and profits, and that goes to Apple and Microsoft and, you know, Facebook even, all these companies that have kind of really figured out how to position themselves as what I'd say into every piece of society. Like literally they touch, you know, people multiple times a day. And in my book, I write about Google wanted to be, Larry Page said, I want to be the new toothbrush. I want someone to use it twice a day or more than twice a day. Mm-hmm. And now the average person uses Google 6 times a day. Mm-hmm. And I think in that, when you start thinking about solving really big problems, you're going to stumble on unintended consequences of other problems, but you're also going to attract people to do that. And I think, you know, you take Elon Musk and he's just always really what he's been good at is galvanizing people to think much, much bigger than they ever have before. And that's where, you know, in the book, I call it a Mars shot instead of a moon shot that Google had. He's like, well, I got to think bigger than Google. So let's go to Mars. Mm-hmm. And whether he believes or not that we're going to go to Mars didn't matter, doesn't matter. You know, and I think in different interviews, he's kind of insinuated, you know, it's we're probably not going to make it to Mars in the way that I wanted to. But what he's done is he attracted all that talent, all the smartest people that used to go to NASA, to SpaceX. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now he has a profitable space company that's shuttling people back and forth and has the government contracts and different things. So it's that thinking bigger mentality that I've kind of brought into boardrooms and senior leadership teams that led me into kind of all kinds of creative places that I get to now play. Because when you avoid worrying about, you know, the small stuff and you can get people thinking about the big things, then you have the possibilities. Now, figuring out how to do that, that's actually much, much easier. And that's, I think, the thing that when you start studying these exponential leaders, you'll attract the right people. The universe will attract the right people into that where you'll start to be able to create even a bigger vision. And if you get the right people, they'll push on your vision to kind of grow even faster. And when companies or individuals or anybody, I always say, you know, Bill Gates has a good quote that's in my book is, you often overestimate what you're going to do in 1 year, but you'll always underestimate what you do in 10 years. And it's a problem with being a mayor or in Congress or anything, you have these time spans that you're only thinking about how to get reelected versus how are we going to dig ourselves out of the hole? You know, how does government become efficient, which is, you know, an oxymoron, right? How, well, it's a longer term vision to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you balance the budget? You probably have to have a longer term vision with both all the political interest to do that, but you have to have that vision. It can't be just that we're going to balance it today and then, you know, in 6 months, we're going to start talking about it again and balance it, you know, in a year. So I think it's these long-term strategies, you know, and even you as a mayor, a lot of the things that you did, you probably didn't get credit for. Mm-hmm. It happened in the next mayor's term, the mayor after that. And the same with
but
the presidential.
I got a lot of credit for things that somebody did before me.
Yeah, there you go. So it just depends on who you followed is how successful you were. And we can see that in presidential politics as well as, you know, how the economy is and all that. We see all these stats and you realize that things take time. Exponential is not instant. But when you have clarity of where you're going, I definitely see, and you can move a group of people there. That's when these exponential companies, these unicorns and all that change the game. And that's where you see, you know, a lot of companies dying because they just don't have that exponential, realizing that these companies that are growing really fast. And I'll give you an example, like Mercedes-Benz was a client, Daimler in Stuttgart, Germany. And back in 2016, 17, 18, we started talking Tesla, and I actually owned a Tesla since 2014. And they all knew that. And this is, you know, this is senior leadership team board level conversations. And I said, this is going to be a disruptor. You know, when are you guys, what are you guys going to do about that? And of course they did a lot of little things. And part of it is they had to double down late to kind of get there because they started thinking bigger about their future of what it is. But now what's interesting, they owned a stake of Tesla. And a lot of people don't know this. They actually put $100 million into Tesla at a point that it was about to fail. And Elon Musk took it. And they actually sold that a few years later for $850 million. But the interesting fact is if they would have held that share, it was like a little less than 10%, 8 or 9%. It would actually be worth more than all of Daimler today.
Wow.
So that's exponential. When you see things that are growing so much faster than these old established companies, they've got to figure out how to either get involved with that exponential company, acquire that exponential company. And that's why you see these big companies, you know, consolidating often, is it's just to maintain market share. It's not even, you know, some of it is to grow, but it's just figuring out how to stay, survive.
What are the common traits that you see amongst leaders who think exponentially?
Well, they think nothing's impossible. And I mean, you see the things that have been created in our lifespan, and you kind of realize, like, 50 years ago, which I just turned 50, you know, in a half century, I had an event. I was just turned 50. So this is my first podcast over 50. But, you know, in 50 years, the amount of technology that's come to the market, we couldn't imagine where we are today, mm-hmm. 50 years ago. And I think that's where, if things are moving twice as fast, or if not four times, and Ray Kurzweil has this this rule of, you know, kind of gains, and, you know, in a 10-year period, it really 4x's, you know, the amount of speed. So just imagine where we're going to where we've been. And that's where AI and quantum computing and all these different kind of technologies are going to take us to places we couldn't even imagine. So right now, is for the real exponential thinker, it's the dreamer that really can dream very, very big and see that they can change industries. And I don't think we ever had the thought process to change an industry, or very few did. You know, I mean, maybe Henry Ford did, and Thomas Watson at IBM, and a few different people. But now we're seeing these small companies that are literally, industries are kind of changing, because you have a group of people that think bigger than everyone else. And if you can get around those groups of people, you literally will be, you know, in a way, thinking so much bigger about what you can do in this world. And that's where I'm at in my current thing, where I just take on these projects, is like, is this project going to impact, you know, a million people or more? Mm-hmm. And that's really my kind of, do I want to work on different things? I just want to work on big things that kind of change the status quo.
Yeah, what I find fascinating is, I think it is important to read to understand the important factors that are around you. Again, like if you were to read Ray Kurzweil, he loved talking about Moore's Law and the idea that the speed of a computer and the amount, the size of a chip was doubling about every 18 months. Well, why is that important? Well, in his early books, he said, we can make projections based upon what we're going to be able to do in the future based upon those speeds, right? So it is good to be able to know that that exists, so that you can think about, where's the world going? Now, some people think Moore's Law is going to die out, but then there's quantum computing and a whole series of other technologies that are going to come about that potentially replace that. At the same time, I think what we saw with the book, The Rational Optimist, was he was really talking about the political structure in many ways. He's talking about trade, how important trade was to the progress of human beings, how much of a difference that made. He said, as long as we allow that to continue to happen, we're going to be okay. Well, now you're into the governmental political realm to a degree, right? And then Peter began talking about the seven steps. I always enjoy listening to those seven steps, because when you begin to understand the chronology of it, you can begin to understand what's happening. If you can, give us the seven steps, if you still remember from the Singularity University.
I don't remember those offhand. You put me on the spot there, Paul.
That's Jeez. Okay.
Do you have them? I'm assuming you must know them then.
So that's the what I know. The most important one is that it's deceptive in the beginning. Right, that the
oh, okay, you're talking about the six D's.
Oh, there we
is
go.
Is it the six
See,
D's?
There, I threw you up by telling you. You did throw me off when you said seven.
I got the six D's. Okay, so once.
By the way, I'm a politician. I'm never. I'm always off on my numbers a little bit. I always exaggerate.
You always exaggerate. To a small degree.
That's what you do as a politician.
Okay, the right? six D's is once something becomes digitalized, it becomes exponential. Uh-huh. And since we're living in a digital world, and almost every new company is digital, there's a long period of deception, where you don't think that that's actually going to make an impact. But what happens is then it starts to barrel up. You have this linear curve of an average company that's in an industry, and they're just going to keep plugging away. And I used to have this conversation quite a bit with the automobile manufacturer, Mercedes, and just say, hey, you guys are doing great. You guys are doing 7, 8, 9, 10%. And a lot of that growth was coming from China, of actually them manufacturing. In fact, half of Mercedes-Benz vehicles that, you know, and I don't know the number now, but this is a few years ago, were sold in China. So it's like half of the cars they made in the world were in China. The other were everywhere else. And that just shows you their growth of China itself. But that deception phase is that you don't realize over a period of time that this technology is starting to kind of gain speed. Once it gets the disruption, then you're never going to catch it again. It literally passes your linear model, and then you're going to take a big hit because it's literally on an exponential curve to eat the market. Then it's really looking at demonetization, democratization, and dematerialization. And you see those three things as it kind of gains speed, as it dematerializes, is like, how does a car dematerialize? Well, the reality is the future generations, and we're starting to see it now, aren't necessarily going to want cars because you got to deal with parking, you got to deal with, it's much easier when you have autonomous vehicles, and we're starting to see it here in the city of Phoenix with Waymo, that something picks you up and takes you. Well, soon, with all your communications, and it probably won't even be a phone, I want you to imagine a life without a phone, because we are starting to become aware of how the phone is becoming a distraction and not necessarily improving our lives. But in that, as a car would come and pick you up when you want to go somewhere, and this is kind of around Elon Musk's Neuralink. I'm not going to say everyone's going to have a Neuralink. I don't believe that. But these technology on an exponential curve is you have to imagine something way, way different than what we have now. Those cars will pick you up, take you where you want. When you walk out, another car will be there, take you where you want. All that will be behind the scenes. And that's where for history, you know, technology has used us. We're now at a pivotal point where we can use technology. And that's where artificial intelligence and robotics and drones and all these different kind of mechanisms that are what I call exponential technologies, they're literally here to change the world or to make your life better. And, you know, someone actually asked me this question today. We were in a meeting and she just said, well, and you know, do you think technology has improved our lives? And this is someone who's very cynical about technology. And I just said, well, I go, the fact that 50 years ago, maybe 100 years ago, the poorest person, you know, in this country is now living better or has access to more food, entertainment, you know, all the different things than the richest person of that time. So yes, technology has improved our lives dramatically. Has it provided more stress? Are we really meant to have all this information coming at us? No, because for 10,000 years, you know, our brain was this. Over the last 400 years, it's accelerated. In the last 50, it's on that exponential curve. That's where we have to adjust our thinking, because if we think how we've always thought, we're going to be disrupted as individuals, personally, professionally, and organizationally. And it's likely that every person on this planet will be disrupted.
And that change is happening faster and faster. So, you know, in our business, we built a healthcare company that almost overnight, we were in 50 different states helping out small and medium-sized employers with their healthcare plan. We created a digital platform. We created a product that was really good for employers with low-wage employees. Nobody else wants the market. But I tell our people all the time, there's some 25-year-old kid out there that tomorrow can replace me, all right, that can replace us. It's so important to stay ahead of the curve. And what begins to happen is the product that you provided that was very profitable yesterday, it's a commodity tomorrow. And the day after that, it might be free.
Yeah.
It might be given away.
Well, that's part of that demonetization in an exponential curve is, you know, there comes a point that every industry is going to go through this. And healthcare is one of those industries that it's fought it and it's kind of managed. And I have a lot of interest in healthcare. And the system is completely broken right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a completely reactive system that doesn't support the long-term health goals of any individual. I mean, you basically have to be almost dying walking into a hospital for you to get the services you need. And I think when insurance companies and actuaries and you start kind of unpeeling this, there's a much better proactive, holistic way to kind of look at healthcare. And part of that, I have a small group of people that are exponential thinkers that are thinking about how to do that, how to take it from a reactive to a proactive or longevity. The reality is we're all aging, you know, is it whether we're going to age well or not? I think that's the question. And I think, you know, the thing we do know about longevity, and this comes from Kurzweil and everything, is, you know, he believes by 2029 that we'll have the chance to live forever. And I think, I'm not saying he's wrong, but I would say that would be rich people for a while, and then eventually it'll get to the masses. I think part of that is right now we actually do have the knowledge to increase our health span, meaning our lifespan can only increase a little bit by environmental factors and what we do, but our health span can increase quite a bit by knowing just these certain kind of supplements and different things and lifestyle choices that you make, where the average adult spends 16 years in a disease for the end of their life. You could bring that down to a month or two, you know, for a person that actually does these things. And I think the healthcare system is going to need that as we have an aging population and, you know, one that is looking, you know, how does it stay afloat? Because right now is completely broke the way it's set up. And I think we're going to see some disruption there. And there's some deceptive companies, you know, like yours, you know, that are out there serving underserved markets that, you know, if they think exponentially and think big enough, they can infinitely grow. I would love to challenge your company to grow exponentially.
Well, that's our goal. I can tell you, you know, my advice to people who are interested in growing in healthcare is if you go focus on the areas that are highly regulated, it's much more difficult. It's much more complicated. Yeah. Find the area that's less regulated, which is what we've done. But I don't want to spend too much time on our company. What I'd really like to do is it seems to me that the mindset of a person who's going to be able to do this almost has to be optimistic. That effectively, you have a very hopeful, optimistic message. Here's not only what can happen to your business, but what's happening to the world. It seems to me that people who have the ability to be able to take advantage of that have to have some form of optimism.
Well, I think it's the difference between a fixed, I mean, at first, if you want to sort of break it down, it's a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. Mm-hmm. You're not able to have an exponential mindset until you at least have a growth mindset. Mm-hmm. And a growth mindset is all about learning and growing. I mean, and I really take individual responsibility that I'm right here in this seat. Like everything in my life has led to a decision to bring me right here in this seat. And this is the most important moment of my life. And that's mm-hmm. an exponential thinking is now how big do I think in this moment and how do I share that? This medium is a way to share that message to get out there further, faster. I think part of the past is then letting go of the things that didn't work and learning from them and then not worrying about the future because you're able to create it right now. And I think that being in the moment of a growth mindset then starts to turn an exponential mindset when you start pushing yourself to think bigger beyond the boundaries of what exists today. And that's where you see these companies or these people that create the companies, that they're exponentially changing because you have early adopters, you have the whole adoption curve, you have the Jeffrey Moore crossing the chasm, and you know as you kind of learn to grow with whatever's presented to you, you pivot and make those things happen. And I've been involved in Techstars and Y Combinator, 500 startups, and seen all these companies kind of grow from nothing. And people that you wouldn't think had any business sense grow into multi-billion dollar companies because they understood that they just had to continue to learn and grow, that they couldn't be stuck with their original idea. And I think that's an important part for an exponential is just how do I think bigger and bigger? And then that's why we see all these billionaires that they're like, well, why are all the billionaires that have made all this money wanting to get off this planet? They know something we don't know? No, they're really just saying exponentially, what's something that would excite me, that it could challenge me in a rocket company's, you know, pushing the boundaries of the limits of what we can do? So, yeah, if you create Amazon, do you want to create another Amazon? Does Jeff Bezos want to create? No. Mm-hmm. He's now focused on his rocket, just like Elon Musk is focused on SpaceX and Richard Branson on, you know, Virgin Galactic. I mean, all these kind of things are just like, I need a challenge to think bigger and bigger. And now it's intergalactic. It's not even like on this planet, which sounds strange, but I think we'll see a lot of things in the future that'll be very strange to people become very normal, just as they have in the past.
I'll tell you what I find to be fascinating is, you know, we had this governmental structure that basically released the individual a long time ago, right? We were really founded during kind of the middle of the Enlightenment. The idea was that science and rationality and individuality all mattered. And so we had a government at its very beginning that said, hey, we're going to empower the individual. Now, for a long time, much of the progress that was happening in society was happening at the governmental level. The government took us to the moon, right? Yeah. Government was building the dams and the bridges and the roadways. But now what we're watching is that individual curve, it's bypassing government. In fact, I would venture to say, I don't know if you agree with this, I'd love your opinion on it, but I would venture to say most of the big things that are going to improve the human condition are going to come from the private sector, not from government.
Well, there's been this transition, and you're exactly right. No one could afford. I mean, if you think our, you know, a lot of people complain about military budgets and that we could do so much different things, but most of the technology that we work with today was invented inside that military budget to experiment and explore. And yet now, and it goes to the idea of Hewlett-Packard probably being the first and born in a garage or born in a dorm room or whatever, these different companies that have become exponential have started to grow so fast and so big. And with our connectivity of the network, it's allowed them to bypass the influence of the government. And that's where companies now have more influence, and why you can say in 2016, social media influenced elections. I mean, there's no way you know, at this point with Cambridge Analytica and all these different things, you realize how many people are really playing to influence people. And that's really the next subject I'm after, is like the status quo is, you know, you don't realize how manipulated the average person is, you know, by the messaging that all these different industries, whatever they want to accomplish, they're able to do on a systemic level. And I think these companies that have controlled the medium, and you look at, there's like four or five technology companies specifically that literally influence people every day and have access to all their purchases and access to all their information, who they're with, how they travel, where they go. And all that's, you know, if you read the fine print of the terms and conditions, are all part of you giving something. You get a free service for that. And then they go sell that service to you to inundate you with things that tell you you're not enough, that you need this, you need that. And that's that consumerism world that we live in, a very materialistic world that is, you know, driven Americans' growth mostly on credit cards and mostly on expanding debt. And that, you know, affects on a personal level. But it also has, you know, given Congress and everybody to say, well, we can have debt too, and we'll just pile it on. And there comes a point, though, who's going to pay it back? And, you know, at this point, the optimistic is that we have a longer term vision to figure that out. But every time we give, you know, pay off people's student loans or do anything on billions and billions of dollars going out, what we're really, and both sides have done it. That's why this isn't a political issue. It's not like Democrats or Republicans, or it's been an issue. It's just like, hey, let me get reelected by doing these populist kind of things. Well, what about my grandkids? Because they're likely to be, you know, in a place that, you know, they have austerity measures on the United States, which sounds crazy, but with the amount of the debt's grown, especially, you know, during COVID and all that, we're not in a good place unless we start having a longer term vision about who we're going to be.
Yeah. You know, if you look at this country's problems, you could fix all of them, or 80%, with just two actions. Just two. Here's the first one. Spend less than we earn at a national level and a local level. Right. Yep. Here's the second one. Be nice. Just be nice to other people.
Yeah.
Right. If we could just get people to do those two things, it dramatically begins to shift it. Okay. But I want to go back to the media. I want to stick with them just for a moment.
Okay.
I'd like to have your thoughts on the evolution of what happened. You know, I think back when I was a little boy, I remember in 1969, I was about 8 or 9 years old. I don't remember exactly what, but I remember literally running home to watch us land on the moon. Right. I went to my grandmother's house. She had a concrete floor. They couldn't afford carpet. They had a television set with the rabbit ears on top. You couldn't really see it very clear on the screen, because you're not only dealing with our television set, but the fact that they've got this connection they're trying to make to the module. But what amazed me was how big of a moment that was for the United States. What amazes me even more is, you know, I was at home watching, having to do spreadsheets, and I was watching the news. And man, there was so much negative news on television for an entire week on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. It didn't matter which one. I could pick out the issues that they were both going through, but it doesn't matter. It was just pure negativity. But for a little moment, you had William Shatner, who comes on because he just got into outer space, because three rich guys were in a contest to figure out who could get the furthest out.
Right.
First, we ignored it. The president didn't go. He didn't show up at the site to watch it. The media acted like it was, you know, there was no countdown. There was no letting us know who the people were that were engaged, talking about what the greater mission was. Will Shatner made it interesting. And I love Will Shatner. I watched every Star Trek there ever was. But the point is, that was the best they could do to figure out an angle that made it work, because they've become so focused on the negativity. And it what it's done is it's created this environment amongst Americans, in my opinion, that does not represent the data. If you look at the data, we've never been doing better than we are now, budget aside. Right, I agree with you on the budget issue. But economically, what we're doing for human progress, the benefits that we're giving to society, the idea that we're beginning to even, there's a great article in The Economist that showed how we're actually beginning to equalize in terms of income distribution. But the point is, what's going on with our media? What do you see that's happening? What's the evolution that's happening, and where does it go?
Well, in my book, I kind of pick on Craigslist a little bit as far as changing, journalism from being not objective, but somewhat objective, to being very subjective, to being satiric and almost, sensationalist journalism. And that's where we really get today, is sensationalism. So, what the reality is, any piece of news, you could read it in the furthest right, paper, and it would have this perspective, and you'd read that same news and it could spin it another way. So they're all just catering to an opinion that oftentimes is your extremes are very negative, and your extremes pull you out of the fact that, and I would just say a lot of our progress is because of exponential thinkers, people that have a growth mindset, that exponential, that have created the jobs, that then that money kind of filters down into society and has kind of improved the quality of life for everyone. And to that point, we're in a kind of unique place in the world that we have a lot of innovative technologies coming to market, so much that everything else is noise, right? And we are doing things every week. There's a innovation that probably is bigger than us landing on the moon, if you really think about what it'll mean to the people of this world. Yet at that time, obviously, from JFK's promise and that generation to the point that we actually landed on the moon, was like the confidence to really be innovative. And what's interesting about you picking that, and I this didn't make my book, but it made my research, is all of those exponential thinkers were really coming of age at that exact time. The Bill Gates, the Steve Jobs, all these people that really kind of changed our mindset about technology. And Bill Gates, in a few years after that, in 1974, said there'll be a computer in every home. Well, he underestimated it, because now there's a computer in every pocket, right? But the point is, that was such an exponential idea, because at the time there wasn't computers in the workplace. And now here we are, 50 years later, and literally every single person, down to honestly a 2-year-old, has an iPad or something, has a computer. And I think that's where you realize is the world is changing to give us access to information. What the media has done at the same time is then said, how do I pick? And it's polarized us. In social media in particular, your feed can lead you further left or further right. It's not going to make you more objective, and it's not going to make you actually more critical thinker, because it's just feeding you dopamine hit after dopamine hit to help you endlessly scroll and keep you there hooked, which is a bigger problem in society, because we're spending more and more time there than we are on television or anything else.
Doom scrolling.
We're stuck in it. And I think part of the process is then, when do we become critical? And I think that's the important part of an exponential thinker.
Explain
they are critical.
When you say, explain that.
So, we can talk politics, or you can talk about any issue, but the reality is if someone were to, you hear people that say, I'm for Trump, everything is Trump. And then you talk about the issues and they know nothing about Trump's issues. Mm-hmm. Well, that is just a follower mentality that has followed their way down a doom scroll, that people that look like them, act like them, drive the same cars or whatever that their community is about, has led them down to say, well, this is my belief. Mm-hmm. Did they ever have any critical thought of what that belief is? Because the reality is, whether you like Trump or not, you have to like certain issues that he has, and you have to dislike others. Like, there's no way you can say I dislike everything that he's ever done. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter, he's part of the human race. You shouldn't even hate him, because then you hate yourself. So it's thinking about, like, how do we actually find the issues that kind of bring us together? And unfortunately, on the other side, you have the same division. It's not like either side has really kind of taken a higher path to say, how do we unite people? Mm-hmm. It's really taken the issue that, you know, how do we divide people? Because I know on these specific issues, and I'll use a former president to kind of drive the point home. It's like,
yeah, because if we talk about Trump, it fills up our feet. It doesn't matter what side you pick either.
Well, that's what people realize. I'm very objective on both sides of this, but we'll pick on Barack Obama. That, you know, his first term, he really understood the demographics and the numbers of the polling, and mm-hmm. he understood that he couldn't really take on LGBTQ because the Black community wouldn't want that. Once he was president, he realized that the Black community wasn't going to turn their back on a Black president. He could take on that issue and gain a little bit more market share. But specifically, while he was running for his first election, he was very against something to where he was very for in the second. And as you know, on a national and even local politics, you have these changing, you know, how do I cater? And now what's interesting is it's very clear that we're just catering to voting groups to kind of get there. But then they become very, very divisive. And I think this is the same with companies. Companies are doing the same thing in their marketing and advertising because they know everything about you. So they know when you need something, want something, they can advertise against other things to push them back to your product. I mean, it's the retargeting. I mean, there's just the technologies are amazing. I mean, I had a digital strategy company and, you know, I always consider myself, I was the madman of the modern age with less martinis, right? You know, so, but you realize that and this is what comes out is, you know, people are massively manipulated to just be average or be status quo. And the exponential thinker starts to be critical and starts to challenge those. And then you start to see growth. And what they do is then they attract other people. And like my social media feed probably looks very different than others. I'm like everyone else. I still look at social media, but I'm very, very choosy on what I see. And a lot of times I'll play games with the algorithm to just get far left, far right, because I want different things to kind of creep into my feed. And, you know, the little black box of AI at Google is like, we can't really figure this guy out, what mm-hmm. he's doing. But I think part of it is because I want to learn and grow. And I realize that if I have any one perspective, you know, whether it's a company's perspective or a political party's perspective, I'm not going to learn and grow. I'm literally going to follow whatever path they want me to follow, because that's how we get our information today. Unfortunately, you know, my reference to my book, Exponential Theory, is Craigslist killed, you know, newspaper advertising, you know, within a few years, and several other companies came along after that. But that really demolished the revenue source for newspapers to where not everyone, newspapers kind of started to drift off as digital kind of came up. And you really took these analog dollars and you made them digital pennies. So then all of a sudden you couldn't focus on local news. You couldn't even focus. You had to if I'm going to get digital pennies, I got to get a point of view that becomes extreme, that gets a tribe of people that says, this is what I believe in. And that's what we see today. We literally see a very divided country that, you know, there's probably 8 or 9 different groups that some merge together or whatever. But I think that's also part of what companies taught politicians, you know, hey, you can divide people and make more and more money. Actually, the more focused you are now in a digital world, the easier it is to spend more money to reach the targeted audience and actually get more market share. And that's what we're seeing across different industries. And that's why seeing so much disruption.
When you know you've been manipulated. We just did a whole series on this in the last show to try to help voters think about their self-agency. And we talked about differing issues, which people may have agreed with or disagreed with, but the issues weren't what was important. It was the framework of your thinking. So if you are Trump or anti-Trump and you form your position based upon issues because of that support or opposition, you've lost your agency. You're no longer thinking critically.
Right.
You've just simply bought into a candidate for or against them, doesn't matter which way you want to pick it. And then you said, okay, now I hate everything he hates or I hate everything he likes. It just depends upon which one you want to pick. But if you think critically, you start to go, wait a minute, I want to think about what issues matter the most to me. And I don't have to agree with the president on everything. In fact, you rarely will if you have agency.
I don't think you ever should.
Right? You should have
areas. That's part of being American.
And that's right, because what it does is you don't give up the entirety of yourself to them.
Right.
We trust the Constitution, but with them, we go, no, no, no. There are areas that I'm not crazy about you yet. You got to keep selling me.
Yep.
All right. I'm not going to give it all to you. You got to keep selling. So to me, that becomes a key factor in how it is that we move forward. Now, here's a question for you, because you've spent a lot of time on boards. You've made money. You don't really need to be out there building a new business, but you want to think bigger. So you're trying to take these ideas that you have and expand them to over 1 million people, because if you could get 1 million people bought in, you could make a change in a bigger way. Talk to me about that program and what you're doing and what you hope to get to.
Yeah, so in Exponential Theory, it's kind of in there in the first chapter as I come up with these seven universal truths that are really kind of outline exponential thinking. And it really is, as I dug into it, it really outlines this idea of what a change agent is. And a change agent is someone who has the agency to change. And part of it's everything we talked about up to this point, you know, being an exponential mindset and being able to think bigger than others and think about where things are going, not where they are. Because a lot of people are just stuck in what's happening. And the word stuck, you're never stuck if you're exponential, because you're going to grow outside of that very, very quickly just by a thought. You know, I rarely have a point where I can't brainstorm an idea to make it bigger, because there's infinite of abundance of opportunity with how connected we are. And honestly, you can pick any industry and take an idea from it and bring it to another industry and literally see it kind of grow. And that's where we see these exponential companies is, you know, and even some of the things I'm doing outside in the creative circles, like screenplays, I'm literally, you know, understanding like what are the things that work from different movies and like how do you build them into something that's better, that's like more, can take people more emotional roller coaster where, you know, as you get people to, you can people to feel their emotions and they're more willing to kind of spring back. And, you know, like everything, I think it's also recognizing that the world is a rubber band, meaning if you pull the rubber band, and politics is a very good example of this, if you pull it too far one way, it springs back to the other. And that's what we currently are seeing in politics. You know, we're saying we're going to go to extreme right, and then we're going to go to extreme left, and then we're going to go back to extreme right. And it's this fact that we have so much divided people in that. My change agents is all about understanding that and taking advantage of that. So our graduates now are disrupting all kinds of little parts. And the ultimate goal is that you create 1 million change agents. And this is me to think bigger, is probably bigger than the goal that Google had, is to organize the world's information. Because now I have 1 million people out there that are wanting to change whatever area that they're most passionate about. They have the tool set, the mindset to be able to go do that. And I really have, through some critical thinking, thought through of what are the neuroscience, the psychology, the behavioral influences to help people kind of think bigger about themselves. Because a lot of times we don't recognize that our own self-talk or, you know, and it goes to, there's a certain amount of things you control. And what most people that live in scarcity, they're not controlling those things. They're worried about all the other things that they are not able to control. Things you control are your thoughts, your habits, the stories you tell yourself, the stories you tell the world, and what you focus on. Beyond that, you can influence everything else. But what everybody's focused on is the environment or the political, you know. It doesn't, you know, in reality, as an exponential entrepreneur, whoever is in DC probably isn't going to impact my ability to kind of exponentially grow whatever company I'm going
to
grow.
Nor is you yelling at your brother-in-law going to change what the president's going to do. And people do it all the time. No.
And that's just energy. And that's how I look at it. It's energy going to something else. But my thoughts about who I am, the habits, and I think this is a big one, because most all of us have bad habits and we can recognize and be aware of them, but how do we nudge ourselves? How do we create the conditions, filters, anchors, to be able to kind of get us to have slightly better habits? And that goes to our health habits. You know, what do we put in our body? You know, in my book, I talk about this, is like, you know, people don't realize, like, you know, and I'll use this example. So Paul, if I gave you $1 million, would you chop off your arm?
No.
Yeah. You could ask almost anyone in the street, doesn't matter what wealth they are, and they're like, would say no. Okay, then you're saying you're worth more than your arm's just worth $1 million. So imagine what you're worth. Okay, so you have a Ferrari. You're actually worth more than a Ferrari. First, I always joke, because I'm not a big fan of tattoos. I'm like, would you put a bumper sticker on a Ferrari? That just gets them in the right mindset. And they're like, well, no, I wouldn't put a bumper sticker on a Ferrari. Well, you're a Ferrari. And I go, you know, in a Ferrari, would you put junk into it? Like, would you not put the right fuel? No. Well, then what are you doing to yourself? You know, if someone's poisoning themselves all the time, or you know, and this goes to food, this goes to alcohol, it goes to drugs, it goes to all these different things. And if you can think of that, it's like you yourself are the most sophisticated thing we know. As much as we've invented all kinds of technologies and gone to the moon and done all these incredible things, this human body, this brain in particular, you know, literally as above, so below, is literally a map or looks just like the universe. We can't even possibly understand what it is and what it can do. And that's where, like, Ray Kurzweil and everything, when you talk about AI, is it going to be able to outthink us? For sure. Is it going to have the emotional intelligence and capacity to actually understand, like, to make good decisions? Not likely in the near term, you know? And I think that's the important thing is to understand is you're already sitting on an exponential tool. Every one of us is exponential. It's just, what are our beliefs, values in our thinking? What are our habits that we're spending our time on? And then what are, and this is really what I take people through, what are the stories we tell ourselves? Because a lot of people tell stories like, well, I could do that, but that would be, and then they always come back. They have a big idea, then they're like, well, in reality, I don't need to do that. And then they justify where they are. What that is it's your ego protecting you from like going to think bigger because we don't want to see you fail because as a kid, you failed 1,000 times to learn something. Mm-hmm. Your subconscious knows that. Your conscious isn't going to make you aware of it, but it's going to pull you back. Once you become aware that I look at all those failures as literally my ability to get to my exponential curve faster, is if I fail faster, I get there faster. So now everything becomes a learning and growth opportunity. And I often, in the companies that I own and are part of, like the first thing I teach people is there is no failure. There's just winning and learning. We will win. We won't win very often, but we will learn a lot.
And winning, it depends upon when.
Yeah.
When am I going to win? I'm going to win.
Yeah. And it's the same with politics or anything. It's like if you have a long enough timeline, and that's what's interesting is, you know, a lot of these exponential companies, people think they happen overnight. No, these were thoughts in someone's heads, and they created the habits, and they started telling them stories, and their stories had to grow. It's even like Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. You know, Facebook was born out of the fact that a kid wanted to get a day to Harvard. You know, and then all of a sudden when he moved to Palo Alto to kind of grow bigger, he's like, oh, there's something bigger here. Now I can think bigger. And he got around Sean Parker and, you know, a lot of people know that story. Then it's like, okay, you're on a stair step to something exponential. The fact is he was willing to learn and grow. There came a point, there's a lot of entrepreneurs or business people out there that may be optimistic, but and it really goes to the American optimist. That's what we need in this world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes to your podcast is the perfect. That's when I heard your name, the name of the podcast. Yeah, I want to be on that because that is me. I mean, I just believe that we're here to solve the biggest problems, you know, as more problems. And part of problem solving is not to focus on the problem. It's focus on the thinking that grows bigger than the problem. And then you don't have the problem. It goes away.
Yeah, I'm going to have you repeat that concept here in a moment because I thought it was so good. It seems to me the idea that you have, I don't know if you're all your million people are entrepreneurs, but they don't need to be.
No.
They could be employees thinking the same way. You know, what I find often is that I have no doubt where my success has come from. My success has come from having no shame in politics and business. And you could argue whether was a success in either one, but I agree with it. Timelines. All right. When am I going to be a success? But without having shame, it didn't matter if I was embarrassed because of what it was that I was going to try to do. I was going to try to do because I wanted the most out of my life. I wanted to be able to go as far as I possibly could. We grew up in a poor neighborhood with trailer parks and biker bars and everything else around us. I wanted to go as far as I possibly could. And so you couldn't shame me. The answer was, it doesn't matter that I fail. I'm better than where I was before. But I see a lot of people with this fear, the fear of being willing to take that next step, to take that challenge. And what happens in it is they end up in this position where they're terrified. So to me, thinking about that terror is important. If you give me 5 facts about any person, I can run an ad that will terrify them.
Yeah.
All right. It doesn't matter if they're on the right or the left. It doesn't matter who they are. I can write an ad that will terrify them. I can tell you the reason I would do that is because if I do that, there's this thing called the amygdala, and it hijacks the neocortex. And when it hijacks it, you can't think rationally, optimistically. Love kind of goes away. It's all about fight, flight, or freeze. Well, that means you've lost your agency. You've lost your ability to believe that you can determine your own destiny, which is why I say don't start with which candidate you support or oppose. Start with your own priority of the things that you care about, and then pick your candidates from that, not in the reverse. Don't go pick your issues based upon what your candidate is saying, which I think is become the predominant factor. But to give people that agency, oftentimes I think employees as well as entrepreneurs don't understand the steps. And you just outlined that, I thought, beautifully. Slow down and repeat them again. The things that you have control over.
So, you know, and I think just to speak to what you're talking about, it's most people spend most of their lives thinking about the things they're unable to control. And most people live most of their lives in the past or in the future that doesn't exist. And that's kind of what I drive down to an exponential mindset. It's that being here right now, knowing that wherever your listener's at this very moment, it's the most important moment of their life. And until they realize that every moment is their most important moment of their life, you know, they're always going to live in fear. And fear is because you're living out a past thing that created limited beliefs. And part of what I do when I coach CEOs and boards and things like that is I think of the person as a supercomputer, as I explained that. And you're really connected to all these other supercomputers. You can create anything you want to create. And part of that is understanding that you have programs in you that were installed in you when you were a kid. And by the time you're 18, you pretty much have a formulated, you know, 90% of, you know, who you are as an identity and who you belong to has been formed. Now we have neuroplasticity, you know, that can change that. The amygdala, as you said, is the hijacker that marketing really plays to, because we create fear, which is false evidence appearing real. Where you get down to what you control is to understand inside your mind and inside your ability to have neuroplasticity is the important part of understanding what are the thoughts that you have about any one subject. And part of an exercise I do is I have people, you know, really dialogue their self-talk. And then I also have something called the everything list, that if you just dump everything on your mind onto a piece of paper of, you know, everything you want to do, everything you have to do, every routine thing you have to do, your automatic nervous system, which is really your stress response or in the kind of highway of controlling everything that happens. One, you can start to slow down your amygdala, because your amygdala was always there from, you know, ancient times. And I always, you know, I think the most common way to say it is the lion on the savannah, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you saw the bush move, you needed to see that, you know, you needed to pay attention to that. Now there's little micro stresses everywhere that some people are stressed all the time because they're living in the past. They're literally living in a situation that they're like, when this happened one time, this, you know, this is my anxiety, this is my worry, my doubt, my fear. And the reality is we live in a very safe world. We have 24/7 news that literally all it does is gives us negativity and feeds us, you know, and you know the stats as far as being the optimist. And Diamantis writes about this in Abundance and Bold in some of his books. Like, what you don't realize is we are living in the safest, you know, most growth-oriented time in all of history. Now, most people are like, you know, this has been the worst year ever.
Yeah, they can't believe it. When you give them that fact that it's never been safer, they cannot believe it.
And in 20 years, you know, in the last 100 years, I think, you know, we talked about COVID, you know, people are like, COVID was the worst year ever. And it's like, it doesn't even in the top 10 of worst years, you know, of far, you know, going back to the Spanish plague. And I mean, so you just realize it's like, we have it very easy. When you have it easy, you don't really get outside your comfort zone. And part of what you control is your comfort zone. Well, if you control your thoughts, your habits, and I take habits as none of us are going to have perfect habits. But if we can become aware of our habits, and we start scheduling the time to do those things or the things that will actually serve us. And I always challenge people to think of 10-year goals, which is really hard for people. People have a hard time with New Year's resolutions, but when you have a 10-year goal, you start to change your daily routines. You know, and it goes like in 10 years, no one visualizes, you know, and we'll just take someone that's an alcoholic. In 10 years, they're not going to visualize themselves as an alcoholic. Well, when they actually paint that picture and I say, use all of your sensory, man, using your, you know, your taste, your like picture a picture 10 years from now of where you are and what you're doing with such clarity that every pixel aligns with who you want to be. And then now you'll start making better decisions day by day by day. Are your habits going to be perfect? Absolutely not. But are you going to start making better habits? You'll start scheduling like, oh, okay, I should exercise. Okay. How do I create triggers that I eat healthier? How do I do these things? And as you age, everybody goes through this process. Like, I can't do what I used to do and get away with it. So the earlier people can learn that, they can do it. So that becomes your habits. Your stories you tell yourself are all based on the past. So now take every one of, like, you had your shame story, right? Mm-hmm. In the end, everything, if everything's to learn and grow, and, you know, we're going to either win or learn, you know, and that's kind of part of a process, then shame or guilt or anything is not there. Now you have a moral compass and you kind of go through that as you kind of grow, but the story you tell yourself and that you tell the world, what we see today when we talk about narcissists and we talk about all this is that these two stories aren't lined up. What we love today and what social media loves is the authentic person, that your inner story becomes your outer story. And as someone that I'm willing to stand on stage and be a comedian and, you know, writing a funny screenplay with a bunch of comedians, you start to think about life and what's funny, but also how do we love and how do we learn and how do we live with each other? You know, it's kind of like, you're be nice. And you realize people are really programmed not to do that because of the stories they've been told about themselves. So it projects it on the world. And we're just a projector of our world. As you see the world sees you. And that's where there's a, say I know 1,000 people, there's 1,000 different Aaron Bears. Meaning they don't know who I am, but they have their version of who I am. And you got to think about that is, then why do you care what any one of them think? Be the best you. And I think that's part of a growth thing when you see exponential leaders is they're unapologetic about who they are. And I think it's just like you and the shame thing. You're unapologetic, and that's why you've accomplished so much and gotten things done and been successful and resilient. Because if you're worried about everyone else, and that's where social media has really hurt this next generation, they're so worried about what everybody else thinks because they're always comparing themselves versus actually my best self. I mean, the fact is there's a ton of people that are hundreds of times more successful than me, but I couldn't be happier to be here right now doing this, knowing what I know and just like having passion to share this message because I know it'll impact some of your listeners. Mm-hmm. And I know it'll have an effect on their friends and that, and it'll share and it'll spread. And that's where I know, and it's to your thing about timeline, is I say I'm going to create 1 million change agents. Well, people are like, well, when are you going to do that? I said, I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. And then a lot of people say, well, Aaron, I think you're going to create 1 billion change agents. And whether it's me or whether it's other people, it doesn't matter. It's like, let's have a positive aspect of what we could possibly do, because what we do know is the mind is so powerful. And if we can use that neuroplasticity to mold us to think bigger, think more exponential, to connect with people, to think, have empathy, and really just, you know, solve bigger problems, because current day problems, they may sound huge, but every time you solve a problem, you create other problems and then they mushroom up. And I think that's where when you have this mindset and you can surround yourself with those people, you can accomplish anything in any subject in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what I, you know, my ultimate goal. And then the last thing is, what do you focus on? Well, if you spend all your time focusing on the fact that you don't have enough money in your bank account, doesn't mean you're going to have money in your bank account. What you resist persists. It's going to persist. And I think part of it is I've, to your point, gotten to a point, I literally said this to someone today, I'm not worried about my day to day. I'm not worried about my future. Could I live forever and not have to be? No, I'm not in a financial place with my spending habits that, like, because I believe I'm going to live a few hundred years old. So I've got a different timeline than other people. And so I think part of that is like, how do I make an impact? You know, and it's never been driven about money or anything like that. And if you really get in these billionaires, most of them that are, it wasn't driven money. It was that they wanted to solve a problem so bad and they wanted to be so important into an industry and they saw just bigger than everyone else. And then they attracted the right people in, and then it was just, and then it just happens, you know? And I think that's the journey I'm on. And it took me a long time to figure that out. It wasn't like, you know, and that's the beauty is I want to share that with all the young people out there to have, to be optimist, because, you know, there's a lot of reasons to listen to news and be as pessimistic about your future as possible. But there's never been a time on this planet where every person, doesn't matter where they come from, their sexual orientation or their race, religion, whatever it is, has a better opportunity today than they've ever had in any time in history, anywhere on this planet or in this universe. And I think what's important is to understand that it comes back to those things you control. And all the rest of it doesn't matter, because if you put any energy to it, then you're focusing on things that you don't necessarily want to happen. And if you want something to happen, it's like focus on the things you control, and that's your comfort zone. And your comfort zone doesn't mean it's comfortable. It's just your norm. Mm-hmm. The only way to grow that is to get beyond fear, false evidence appearing real, to learn and grow, and then you learn and grow your comfort zone. And we're only as big as how comfortable we are when we do that. And, you know, a lot of people that make money, you know, lose it right away. It's like lottery winners will spend it all or whatever, and because they're not comfortable with it. They don't understand what it is, and they never saw themselves having it. And it's like NFL players that are in the NFL and then they become bankrupt, or, you know, it's they didn't think they'd have it. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is you have to have that mindset shift. And I do believe we're going through a societal mindset shift to think bigger. I think with that, it's a rubber band, meaning that we're going to see some ugly before we see the optimist.
So let's talk about that for a moment. So you're writing a new book. You were deeply involved in the Republican Party, and you flipped over to No Labels. Tell me what's going on there with that with the whole thing there.
Well, I mean, we'll create lots of comments, I guess, in your section. You know, as far as being Republican, conservative values, you know, I probably fit into what I'd say a majority of people. I have very conservative values fiscally, and then I would also say there's some social issues that are going to be 10x bigger if we do not take care of them. Mm-hmm. And then there's these other issues that aren't necessarily Republican or Democrat, but they've been attached, you know, whether it's abortion or gun rights or, you know, some of these different things that really divide people. Mm-hmm. I'm going to throw those out because I'll keep us safe there. The bottom line I will say about the abortion issue is when Nixon was there, the Republicans thought very differently until the religious right said, hey, we'll come to this as long as you take on this issue. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, you know, traditional conservative values is like smaller government, you know, mm-hmm. it means like, well, let's not regulate the bedroom. Let's not, you know, regulate a woman's body. Mm-hmm. You know, those are different things. So I'm really now going to create some comments. Those things aside.
Yeah, you almost didn't comment on it.
I didn't, almost didn't. I had to. But I think the opportunity of learning and growth is to understand what do we do control. And I think it goes back to kind of this exponential model is how do we start thinking bigger? The bottom line is, you know, and I'll say Trump is not necessarily doesn't have conservative values. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the spending is not conservative. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if I were just to look at presidential candidates, well, you know, Republicans have spent far more than Democrats have spent over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that just then kind of flips everyone that says I'm a conservative because I want to have small government and fiscally responsible. I don't know that you can actually make that argument anymore. And this is critical thinking, right? This is like thinking about the issues of why you are something or not. There's all these other social issues that you just can't ignore because now the mass of the population is a very different population than it was in the past. So as changing demographics and psychographics, if the Republican Party wants to stay, you know, relevant, it's got to change some of its issues. Now, unfortunately, the Democrats never took advantage of that. They did the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So you have this polarization. You know, as you said, I was involved with No Labels, which really didn't have much of a chance, but it had a chance to kind of have a dialogue around mm-hmm. what could be. There really wasn't, unfortunately, the candidates to do it. Mm-hmm. That would, because of the way the political system is built, there is this problem solvers caucus that's in Congress that, you know, says they will solve problems and vote on the issues for their constituents. But when it gets down to it, they're literally forced by their own parties to kind of vote along party lines, or then they're literally, you know, their power and influence kind of relinquishes. And we saw this in Kristen Sinema. So I think in the long term, if we can just help everybody think longer term, all the parties would start to think about the middle class, which pays for this country. Mm-hmm. And the middle class, and I'm saying to people that aren't very wealthy at all, to people that are, you would consider very wealthy, you know, the 80% of people in the middle that really have a stake in this, that really pay the taxes, pay the bills, make sure that we have fire police on a local, national, all the different levels, it's important to start thinking about what are they going to need? Because we literally have put so much pressure on those people that politically they're getting frustrated. And, you know, this next election, you know, we have a couple candidates that candidly, you know, whatever side you're on, it doesn't really matter, aren't very popular.
Worst I've seen.
Yeah. Aren't very popular on either side. And mm-hmm. we have just, you know, Biden is the now the lowest ranking over the last, I think, 50 years, the president with the lowest ratings. And then you got Trump, that is probably the most polarizing character in modern American history, that honestly, neither of them represent the masses. I mean, it's not to say that they won't, really, as they shift, and they get to this debate, or if they get to, they're just going to say things that are populist to their groups, which is just going to divide our country more. And that's the sad part of, our system today, is we have to think bigger than what we have, because we also don't need, a couple presidents that are, aging. That's not necessarily the new America. And we've got to think bigger about, like, what is the future, because nationalism is not, you said about trade, like, I'm a graduate, I got my MBA from Thunderbird here in town, and, is trade not wars? When you trade with people, you don't go to war with them. Mm-hmm. Well, when we start pulling back from trade, we start creating wars. Mm-hmm. And I think as you see the geopolitical now, you're starting to see that happen. And mm-hmm. that's a scary thing for a future, is how do we help all people on this planet prosper, mm-hmm. and not let, a few egos and political influences kind of take the history of this world in a way that we want to go, because, I just say the majority of the Russian people don't want to be in a war with Ukraine. Mm-hmm. The Israeli issue I won't touch, but it's very, very complicated, that it's generational trauma just feeding into generational trauma. Mm-hmm. So how do we solve these? We have to think bigger. I mean, we have to absolutely kind of get our heads around what could be, not what has been, because we're all just focused on history. And unfortunately, most of the people in charge are historians, and, mm-hmm. They're saying, well, this is going to happen with this. Well, then they make that happen. Mm-hmm. And we have to have, Einstein said, you're not able to solve a problem with the same thinking that created it. You have to come up with bigger thinking. And that's part of Kurt's will and Diamantis and all the innovation in this world, is because we didn't accept what is. Mm-hmm. And right now we're just accepting what is, whether it's candidate on the left, right, whatever it is, we're just, that's what is, and I have no control over it. And now you go back to your world and you realize, like, how powerless we are unless we start to create a movement of thinking critically and start really thinking exponentially, because we can solve these problems as a society better than we ever have in history. And that, I believe we will. I do believe we will. I believe we'll have some real pains along the way that kind of stretch that rubber band in the wrong direction, and I think it's going to flip back the other direction. And that's where, if political parties just understood that, you're not able to kind of stretch it to an extreme point of view, otherwise you're going to lose a majority of the people. And that's what we've seen on both sides, unfortunately.
Yeah, my optimism comes from the idea that I do believe that these two candidates, who are highly problematic, are going to put us in a position where change is inevitable. Right. It's going to happen. So, we're pushing an initiative in Arizona, which is being pushed in different places around the country, but it's based upon this idea that the existing political system, if you think about the numbers today, about 70% of the voters are registered to vote. About in Arizona, a little over a third, the largest group, are independent or unaffiliated. And that's a change, right? People have been giving up on the parties. But that means you have about 30% that are in a party times the 70%. You're talking about 21% of everyone could vote in a primary. Then you go, okay, well, what's the turnout? 30%, 35 at a high, right? Oh, well, now we're talking about 6% of the public. And then 70% of the 5,000 seats in America have been gerrymandered to the point where you never have a general election. Well, these candidates don't even learn how to talk to people who don't think like them. All right. It doesn't mean that they should give up on their values, but the idea that a Republican should talk to a Democrat and independents and unaffiliated voters, that's not important in America. I mean, it is important, especially if you want people to be able to think broader. In fact, I'd reverse it. If you think you know everything, then you're done growing.
Yeah.
You're finished, right? You have to listen to other people. And there are things that Republicans can give us that are benefits, and there are things that Democrats can give us that are benefits. But they're also a benefit to that group in the middle that is just being left out of the process.
Yeah.
They're not being included. I think the public has gotten to the point where they're fed up with that, and they're going to look for a change. And that's going to create over the next 20 years, a vastly different legislature and Congress. Now, let's cover this new book that you're doing. I think it's fun.
Yeah, well, I have part of it is it's a lot of this messaging around change. And, you know, the reality is, the book's called Fuck the Status Quo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really is this idea that we're societal influences. And, you know, it starts with big pharma and big food and, you know, the influence they have on big media that ultimately influence every decision that everyone makes in their household as consumers. And it's creating a overspending epidemic in all of America that's created more debt, consumer debt than we are really should have. And, you know, we're bordering on being bankrupt because we've actually learned how to manipulate the amygdala, as you kind of keenly put out. And we've learned to say, how do we tell someone they're not good enough or that they have to have this to fit in, to belong, or that their identity as a person is, you know, this if they don't do this. And it's you know, it's done in politics, but, you know, big pharma as an example, you know, in my book as I do my research, you know, they have 10x the amount of spending of lobbying than oil does in D.C.
Wow.
So special interest is also, you know, everyone can look at the food pyramid and say that that's not what should be the healthiest thing for an American diet. Mm-hmm. Then you realize what special interests were involved in that. You look at the issue I said with Obama or different things. I mean, all the special interest is in there, and you see how people vote and how they get their money, and it becomes very, very clear. That's the beauty of technology, is we've now figured that all out. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was always the case. You know, I'll give you a brief story. I was in Mitch McConnell's office probably like 15 years ago, and he said, the real downfall of us getting things done on a two-party system was when the jet, and this sounds crazy because he's one of the only people that could live through this, is when the jet airplane came. Because as Congress people, they're, you know, 2 years, they're like, I gotta go back and campaign. So he said, what happened is we used to play at the congressional and different country clubs. We had no problem playing at the country club and working something out, two parties. It was never something that we went out in public and did a lot of. We did more of it than now, but now it's like, you know, it's a sacrilege. If Nancy Pelosi was having dinner with Mitch McConnell at a, you know, that would have been something that really raised some flags for both parties.
The two worlds would have melted down.
Yeah, it would have just spontaneous combustion. But coming back to the status quo, I think it's literally this idea that this polarization that we've kind of created, you know, getting people to be more critical thinking, understanding, you know, that everything you see is really to manipulate you to either buy a product, believe in a viewpoint that you may not be your current viewpoint. And I think part of it is it's made us very much not trust our intuition. And what I would say is, you know, anytime you say I go with my gut instinct or I go with my heart, and I say this because what we now know with neuroscience is that your gut has a lot of, you know, your vagus nerve kind of connects to it, and your heart and your gut kind of connect a lot more of your thinking than we ever thought. And it's connecting us to the world. So then it's thinking bigger than just us. You know, I think of it as our super conscious. You know, we have a subconscious that we don't necessarily, as our automatic nervous system, kind of controlling things automatically. Our conscious mind is the, you know, prefrontal cortex, which is your executive decision-making functioning, which candidly nowadays, because it has so much information, it's overthinking. So really, you shouldn't trust your executive, you know, your executive decision-maker, your prefrontal cortex, because literally it's been thinking because it has so much information on whatever you've seen. And if you don't control what you've seen, so you got to think about, you know, most people, Americans all need to be on, you know, a different diet than we're on as far as obesity and everything, but they also need to be on an information diet. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is to understand what sources you get your information and different things. But what that comes down to is really challenging the status quo, is really challenging all the people around you. Like I always say, I give good dinner party because I'm going to make the conversation interesting. And I'm probably going to challenge people's thinking in ways that they haven't been able to, because I'm not necessarily taking opinion to say I'm against you or against your thinking. because I'm thinking bigger. The problem with today in politics and everything, and that story that I told you about Mitch McConnell, is today we just see we're against things. And against things sells. If I'm against them, in fact, people will vote for things they're against more than they'll vote things they're for. And it's that negative dopamine hit that says, I'm going to solve this problem for the kids or for this or for that. Where what we really want to get to critical thinkers and challenging the status quo is, okay, how do we think about this completely differently? And as a facilitator, and even I facilitate a lot of political functionings, and Senator John McCain was someone that helped start a foundation I started with, Arizona Foundation. And, you know, I spent some time with him before his passing. And, you know, as a, someone who's called Maverick, my son's name is Maverick, you know, someone who's a Maverick to kind of challenge the status quo. This book really is about, you know, how do we actually think differently about the issues we have? Because the reality is everyone's overthought the issues we have to anchor themselves into positions that no one wins. And when we have a lose-lose situation, that's not good for society. So our status quo is all trapped in a lose-lose, where all we need is some exponential thinkers to think bigger, to believe that they can make that impact, and also create the movements that need to happen. And that's my change agents. It goes back to that, is you said they don't all have to be entrepreneurs. No, they just all have to be, you know, all of a sudden they're going to, at every dinner table in America that they're at, will be challenging thinking and making people think a little bit more critically, and then ultimately thinking bigger. And when you think bigger, life improves. Like, I don't have the stress, worries, anxieties, and fears and doubts about my future as most people. It's just going to happen. Like, I know I have to live in this moment. I know that everything that happened in my past, I have no regrets or resentment about it. It was for me to learn and grow to be here in this moment. And I just got to make the best of this moment. And now life gets easy. Like, I don't have the worries and stress and those things. Social media, which generally takes us back to nostalgia, to something that kind of get us, trigger us, or into a future of like what you won't have. We've just got to learn to understand and accept it at face value, and understand that politicians are going to tell you what is going to be important that they think you're going to vote for them, not necessarily what they believe. And I think that's a world that we now know is very, very, very different than a Senator McCain that somewhat avoided social media his whole life, was able to kind of get out of that. And I think we're in a place that, you know, the beauty of that is as people become aware, and like I said, is for history, technology has used us. Now we should be able to use technology in a way to help us think bigger. And that's where AI is so promising. And I don't have the, just like any other technology that's come out in this world, you know, the guys that own the horses, they were really worried about the cars, you know, same with computers. Like, the computers are like, the printing industry is like, well, we don't want computers because no one will print. Well, what happened when we networked an office? Everybody printed everything, and it made a, you know, every little thing. We have no idea the impact of AI, but what we do know is going to change everything. And I think there's a lot of positive opportunities in that, and more positive things will come out of that because of the bigger thinkers. Because the good thing is that small thinkers are negative thinkers. They don't do anything. So that's the masses. That's the status quo. That's the norm. We just need to create more people that think like, okay, what would be good for this? And there are some bad actors that can think big for financial advantage. And we see that, and we often, the news tells us all about those people. But the reality of what you just said is putting William Shatner in space is a positive news story. Is like, okay, a private company doing this, what is possible now? Because anything's possible.
Yeah. You know, it's a, to me, your story is one that, the story that you're telling is one that recognizes fundamentally what has made us successful has been our focus on the individual. And that really took two things. The first one was for the individual to think big. And I would argue we've actually been thinking big for a long time. If you really go back in our history, those folks who got into a covered wagon and faced disease and pestilence and being killed by Native Americans, all the things that they had to face, that was thinking big, right? they were really putting things out there. But you as an individual have to have agency, because if we don't have agency as an individual, we're not going to be successful. And at the same time, your second book seems to me to be buying into the idea that we also have to be careful about the ability for big organizations, whether it be government or corporations, to extract from us the ability to innovate, right? So I'm a big supporter of more limited government, especially on things like AI, because I'm convinced we only really beat the Chinese if we win on that very issue. We lose on that issue, we've lost everything. You start putting a lot of controls and clamps around it, we won't innovate as much. And if you give it all to one company, that company will do everything they can to keep other innovators out of the space, right? So the goal has been, the reason we created monopoly laws is because we understood that. One of the comments given by the guy who wrote the book, Why Nations Fail, he said that if you looked at two individuals, Carlos Slim and Bill Gates, Bill Gates actually added about 3% to our overall GDP in creating a product that other people could compete with. Carlos Slim was able to gain a monopoly on cell phones. He made billions of dollars also, but he actually reduced the amount of gross domestic product because he stopped other people from being able to innovate against him. Those two keys are important. It's a limitation, not just of government, but a limitation of those larger powers that will extract powers away from smaller inventors, smaller creators who are trying to think big as well, who aren't trying to protect this quarter's profits. They're trying to figure out how to build a better world.
Yeah, I mean, it's now that we're connected, I think, you know, the beauty of this world is it gives a lot more people, and exponentially a number of more people, that have access to disrupt whatever they want to disrupt. And it's why you see these social movements that are so big and sometimes confusing, you know. I mean, and I write about them in the book, my first book, Exponential Theory. And you realize, like, Occupy Wall Street, you know, was able to kind of impact almost every city. You realize on campuses now, people are protesting in almost every city. And that's because technology is inspiring people to kind of have a voice and do these things at scale, where, you know, Kent State had a protest and it was shot down because of a very different time, but it didn't spread to every campus. It was on every campus, but it was very violent on that campus. We're just in a place where, you know, the individual, you know, can create global change. And I think, you know, to your point about thinking bigger and keeping competition is like, and I didn't know that. That's very interesting about the Bill Gates and Carlos Slim. But, you know, every one of these technologies, I take one of the stories I have in my book is about FedEx. And, you know, the Fred Smith who created FedEx said, you know, we wouldn't have been a great company without UPS. It challenged us to kind of be great. We would have never got to 24-hour delivery. You know, we would have never got to the goals that we wanted to without competition. And I think that's been the American way, is competition. And it's like the electric vehicle that 25, 30 years ago, we had electric vehicle that potentially could have changed the market then and was killed by the oil company, special interests in the government. And, you know, here we are 30 years later, somehow Elon Musk was able to overcome that, you know, and really a media campaign that, you know, and he still doesn't have necessarily the U.S. government on his side. And it's kind of crazy as an American-born company. And
you would think we'd be putting him up on our shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is American innovation. And, you know, I think that's where we have to kind of understand, like, the longer-term picture of the special interest that's behind these things. That's all because they get money from old interests. Tesla wasn't necessarily, they didn't give to politics. So then they become... And that's the strangest thing when you start to think about that is, okay, well, we'll bail these automotive companies out in 2008, 2009, and then we'll support them as much as possible. And then we'll literally create, you know, and this is, you know, we have the FTC to create, you know, not to create monopolies, but then we'll kind of try to squash innovation that's going to disrupt that. Now that's gone. And now and it's only gone because of a mindset, an exponential mindset. And that's kind of want to drive home. It's just because of thought in one man's head that he could do that. And he's done that in 7 or 8 industries now. And that's where you see Rivian and all these other companies that are at scale now, kind of scaling electric vehicle companies, which, you know, we haven't had a new automotive company since the 50s, you know, that really was at scale. And I think that's an important part of our new American story. And it's also a part of, if you really look at, we always want to say our, you know, this kind of nationalist is like American manufacturing is coming back because we're creating innovation here in manufacturing, not because, you know, it's, you know, and it's, there's a way to create efficiencies by scale And I think we're starting to figure out that. And that's where, you know, Arizona alone, you know, just with semiconductors, it's going to change our economy completely.
Big time.
Completely.
Yeah.
I mean, and that will impact every part of Arizona, where we're a relatively poor state. People think we're a rich state, but I work with APS, and, you know, you really look outside of this central area in Phoenix, rurally, like we're very impoverished. And the one indicator globally, and this is I always find this interesting, is your GDP is exactly equivalent to the amount of power consumption. And that's where like places like Singapore and Dubai would consider to have the richest standards of living. They actually use more energy than us in America. Now, take me wrong, America uses a lot more than the rest of the world, but so how do we actually increase that in a responsible way to where we can do that? We're heading towards a cliff on that with electric vehicles hitting the grid, with the semiconductor plants hitting the grid. Those are all things that we have to think about in the future to kind of how do we scale to the future to be sustainable and renewable, but in a responsible way. We can't run there and expect this system not to collapse. And I think that's just another parallel thing of what social media, what politics, what companies are kind of going through is it's the same story in a different slice or different viewpoint of the world.
Yep. Aaron Baer, thank you very much. That's a beautiful talk. I appreciate it very much. Thanks for being on The Optimistic American.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thanks.